The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Oh, hello, my fellow fear freaks. It's your late pal, the Chris Keeper, here at the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I was just sitting down to a crunchy sandwich of Red Devil canned ham salad, sprinkled with grubs and beetles. I got the recipe from Alice Cooper himself. Today I'm joined by two creepy cinemaphile co-hosts, Luke, Jack, and Eddie, and the hallowed hair metal hero, as we pop the cork on a 2-liter bottle of Satan in John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness.
Joined by two other horror hounds, Luke Giaconetti, otherwise known as Al Jacone, and Christopher Tyler, the hair metal hero.
I've got a message for you, and you're not gonna like it.
You gotta say it with a mouthful of, like, insects.
I've got a message for you.
Yes.
There we go.
Now, Luke, give us a little rundown of your what you do and
what I do and how I do it.
Podcast word and how you do it and how you do it so well.
Yeah. Well, like I said, my name is Luke. As Chris said, my name is Luke Giaconetti. I'm known as El Jacone on the two True Freaks board. I run a couple of different comic book blogs. I run Being Carter Hall, which is one fan's journey into Hawk fandom, at beingcarterhall.blogspot.com. I also run a more general comic book blog called El Jacone's Comic Book Bunker at eljaconesbunker.blogspot.com. And for a number of years, starting in 2002 and running up until actually last year or so, I ran the now defunct Luke's Vault of Horror website, where I detailed all of my missives and viewings on the horror genre, primarily focusing on film critique. I'm looking for a new host for that right now because this is how old school it was. I actually hosted it on GeoCities, and now clearly I have hosts for that. So I'll try to get that back up. Looking for a good hosting service right now. Hopefully I can get that back online. But man, just looking forward to talking some horror with a couple of gore hounds.
Yes, mm-hmm. And Christopher Tyler, we know what you do.
Yeah, I'm a
rock.
I do rock, but other than that, I'm a pimple on the ass of society.
A rockin' pimple on the ass of society. Come on,
thank
man.
You.
You're
thank
a pimple
you.
With a guitar in your hand. In your
yes.
Whatever yeah, a pimple I'm... uses to play guitar.
He's a pimple who goes up to 11.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Awesome. All right. We can tell the self-esteem is flowing in horror land tonight. So we're starting out. What a weird movie to start out a new show and to start out. I mean, what this is eventually going to become, not the show, but the beginning of the show, is we're probably going to march right through all the John Carpenter movies. Because I love John. We all love John Carpenter. He was born in my hometown. So I'm biased, and I guess this all started. It started as sort of on the response to the Serbian film, and the thread for that. And somehow, maybe it was we were talking about Scott in a can or something, but somehow Satan in a can came up and. And this movie came up as a very underappreciated John Carpenter movie. And to be honest, I'd almost forgotten about it. You know, as soon as somebody mentioned Prince of Darkness, it was just like, oh my God, I remember going to the theater to see that when it first came out. And despite like Siskel and Ebert's review of it, I went to see it anyway and was not disappointed. It was, you know. It was no Big Trouble in Little China or The Thing, but It was weird. It was sort of sandwiched in between Big Trouble in Little China and They Live. And I knew it had to have been somewhere in there because he's got two of the actors from Big Trouble in Little China. So he probably just was like, hey, you know, stick around. I got another movie, little low-budget movie going. But boy, the critics hated this movie.
Oh, yeah. When this movie came out, this was pretty routinely savaged. And I think that may be part of the reason why the film is so underappreciated now is because at the time it was pretty much seen as a critical disaster, and it really was not very successful commercially either, I don't believe. Another interesting thing, you mentioned Big Trouble in Little China. I want to say, I'm not sure on the details of this, but I have read that when the studio changed the ending to Big Trouble in Little China, Carpenter got into a pretty heated discussion, let's say, with some of the studio executives about them changing the film. And that led to a deal where he could do, I believe it was either one or two, really low-budget films where he would have complete creative control.
Yeah, I think he got $3 million for each movie or something like that.
Yeah, it was a low number even then in the mid-'80s. And the first film to come out of that agreement was Prince of Darkness. So for good or ill, what we got was what Carpenter wanted. So,
well, for $3 million, it's not, you know, and it is sort of a Roger Corman-y type of, it has that feel, it reminded me of, I as soon as I saw the two actors from Big Trouble in Little China, I started thinking of the whole Roger Corman thing, where he would be filming one of his higher budget movies, and he would take some of the sets and the off hours, they would film another movie on cheaper film stock, you know, with a simpler story, and then they would get two films shot for a little more than the price of one. And that's what this sort of had the feeling to. It had the feeling of something, you know, that Carpenter, you know, purposely wrote to be, you know, it doesn't really, the special effects in it are more just like trick photography, you know, water dripping up and stuff like that, and you know, hands going through mirrors and things like that.
I was going to say, don't forget the hideous pizza faces.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, yeah, all classic practical effects. It has,
yeah.
And one of the most awesome classic practical effects of all, and I looked it up, and it was, and he actually did, he let Alice Cooper bring his prop to run the guy through. So it was when Alice Cooper ran that guy through at the end, it was, you know, he was basically, he brought his prop from his stage show and did his shtick out from on stage.
Well, I'm guessing that's why Cooper is the one who actually does that stunt.
Yes.
when you talk about the effects and that they're just practical effects, and I you can't get much more fresh intelligence than this. I watched the film this afternoon in preparation for this show because, you know, that was the time that my wife and son went to the store. So anyway, the one of the notes I have here is simple but effective for the special effects. When, you know, when the water is dripping up and it's all pooled on the ceiling, you know, intellectually, we know how that was shot. We know it's just, you know, filmed upside down and then reversed. But when you're watching it in the context of the story, that's extremely effective.
Yeah.
You know, that especially since we've been talking about, you know, he says, say goodbye to classical reality, and we're talking about theoretical physics and subatomic particles and, you know, all this other stuff. The idea of a physical law being broken and water flowing up is extremely, it hits the target, it hits the mark right where it needs to go in that point in the story.
Yeah, it's not subtle, but it is effective. It's up is down and down is up, you know, and it's just echoing, you know, the professor's words from when he was teaching the class at the beginning.
Yeah. The flesh is real and we can touch it and all that. And
yes. Doing his little, he even does a little Yoda like, after tugging on his cheek.
Good old Victor Wong.
I love him. He's one of my favorite actors. I don't know how I forgot, but when I watched this again, I like almost like cried out for joy when I saw Donald Pleasance show up. It's just like, oh God, yes, here comes some scenery chewing.
I was really hoping he was going to pound a desk and say, it's the ultimate evil. But,
there's something about his over-emoting and the way John Carpenter and he work together, you know. I mean, I think John Carpenter's really good with those classic older guy actors like Cabby and Ernest Borgnine and Escape from New York. Just awesome, you know, chewing the scenery left and right perfectly, you know. And I just love seeing Donald Pleasance having, you know, crises of faith and freaking out and speaking all portentously and sweating and...
One thing I'd forgotten about was I watched this film, let's see, I guess it was a little over 2 years ago, and then I hadn't seen it since. And one thing that talking about Victor Wong and Donald Pleasance, one thing that I thought was interesting and kind of a typical Carpenter idea to take something that's kind of a trope of the genre and kind of twist it and put it on its ear a little bit, was that you've got the priest and the professor who are friends, whereas normally the man of faith and the man of science in a horror film would be antagonistic to each other.
Yeah, they'd be at odds.
Right, and it's real subtle. They set it up when the students see the note that he wants to see them in his office, and they say, "Oh, didn't he do? He did a series of debates with that English priest on the BBC, you know." And so it's just a little background thing, but it sells it. You're like, okay, you know, your mind fills in the details that, okay, these guys had a series of, I'm guessing, televised debates, and they were probably on opposite ends of the fence, and just through, you know, working through this, they've come to a common ground and they've become friends enough that he's willing to bring himself and all of his grad students in when his priest friend says, you know, it's the ultimate evil in a can.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You have Donald Pleasance as the priest having to confront some things about his religion that are more scientific towards the end, and then you've got the scientist who's got to, you know, when you start hitting quantum physics, you start mixing the theological in with science. So you had, and you know, and you had also the, once again, another very, just very simple image, but you know, you had them setting up all their equipment in the gutted out church, you know. So, you know, you had an empty church with, you know, a few paintings on the wall and, you know, scientific equipment being set up in it, and, you know, the Satan in a can with different, you know, meters and stuff around it, and and lots of, you know, the evil controlling ants, and I guess I thought it was kind of weird that Carpenter compares ants and bugs and street people.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's simple minds, I guess.
Yes.
You guys probably know this, but about the time when Prince of Darkness was filmed, right around that time, the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of mental hospitals in a lot of the major cities across the country, if they were no longer receiving funding, they simply shut down and dumped all of the inmates onto the street. So there was, at that time, the possibility of roving gangs of homeless folk who were mentally mentally imbalanced. And in fact, one of the girls talks about that, you know, normally schizophrenics have certain tics and traits that they do, and that these people aren't doing it. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're going to get a gang of crazy homeless people, you know, who else but the Coop could lead that?
Well,
you know,
John Carpenter was not a fan of Ronald Reagan, and you know, and They Live was the next movie after this.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, his comment on Reaganomics and, you know, that whole 80s era, you know, of big business and, you know, just sort of business dominating everything in the sort of me personality. So, and you know, this was immediately before that, so he was probably of that mindset. That's and I like that he wrote the screenplay under the name Quartermass too.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, definitely, because you were talking before, Chris, about you got the feeling of like a Roger Corman type of like an AIP film. This also, one of the vibes this gave me is some of the later Hammer and early Amicus films. Definitely the idea of taking, because the Amicus films were not shy from using this, the supernatural, the kind of, typical satanic stuff, and neither was Hammer later on. And, so it's that same kind of thing. It's set in a very small area. There's a lot of sets reused. There's a lot of, there's a lot of pontification. There's a lot of, like we said, simple but effective special effects. So I definitely got that British vibe from it, which is, again, appropriate for, guys like Donald Pleasance being in there. And, getting to Quartermass, all four of those stories dealt with the juxtaposition of the supernatural and the scientific. Quartermass was one of the first popular, scientist heroes of our, of the modern era. And so actually what's funny is that I forget this guy's name. His last name is Neil, which is why it's Neil University that that Marsh comes from, who actually wrote the film. He was also the original writer for Halloween 3.
Yeah, and he wasn't too happy about like they screwed up Halloween, his screenplay for Halloween 3, or they changed it, and he wasn't too happy about that.
He was not happy at all.
So when the credit came out for the writing for the screenplay for Prince of Darkness under Quartermass, Neil thought that people were going to assume it was him, and he didn't want to be associated with Carpenter anymore after Halloween 3. It's Halloween 3. What are you going to do?
It gave us a Silver Shamrock theme.
Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock.
Yeah. as a side note, my brother calls me leading up to Halloween and leaves that message on my phone. Silver Shamrock song just about every year.
It's a truly creepy, happy song. I'm not that down on that movie. I thought that movie,
neither am I,
just taken as what it is,
right,
is a very fun thing and kind of a neat idea. I like the idea of little kids having Halloween masks that are going to turn their face into bugs.
Halloween 3 is another one that gets a bad rep, just because it's not the shape killing teenagers. But, if we're going to do a show about underrated horror films that don't deserve their rep, I think that'd take us on until we're all old and gray,
picking out movies.
Yeah.
a lot of times the best horror movies are reviled when they first come out. Now, I just remember. And I went back onto YouTube, and I probably won't put it onto here because it's a copyrighted show or whatever, but I went back and watched. Maybe I'll just put a link up or a clip up on the page of the Siskel and Ebert review of it, and they savage it. And I remember them saying, this movie looks like it was just like, they filmed a lot of stuff, didn't know what to do with it, and just sort of hacked it all together and blah, blah, blah. And it's not like that. I remember sitting in the movie theater going, this makes sense to me. I'm following this fine. As a matter of fact, it's a fairly simple storyline. The only time it starts to maybe, I would think lose anybody is when you start getting messages from the future that are being transmitted as tachyon beams and are, this is not a dream and this is a message, which I thought was great, a great just sort of random idea to throw into the whole thing.
It becomes a nice recurring motif where every time somebody's asleep, we get a little bit more of that.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that it's creepy as hell, too.
Yes, it is. It just comes out of nowhere, too. I love when all of a sudden, like, a science fiction idea will pop into a movie like that, like three quarters of the way through the movie. All of a sudden, you're like, wait, they're transmitting from the future? I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it.
And what I was going to add to that is another twist that Carpenter puts on that is that we're, you know, we see the clip of that, I think, three times when people are asleep. And yes. Then you have the discussion between Victor Wong and Donald Pleasance about what it is. And he talks about that, as, you know, the longer we're here, we'll get more and more of it, and we're all sharing the same dream. And Victor Wong, you know, later in the lab, they talk about the tachyons, and, you know, they talk about the position of the Earth relative to where the transmitter is and all that. So they establish what it is. And then at the end, when Marsh is having it for the last time, and we get the full thing, and it's Danforth coming out of the church, and he wakes up, and then, of course, you got the little shocker there. Now you question, at least I do, is, well, was he getting the transmission, or was he having a dream about the transmission?
Ooh, never, you know, thought of that, Dan, that way.
Has future really changed, and Danforth is going to be the vessel, or is he just dreaming that?
Yeah, at that point, it could be either. Well, once he's had the transmission, it could be a dream at any point after that.
Yeah. So it's that to me is like, well, it's like, you know, we really don't know what's going on, and that's I'm cool with that because frankly, we shouldn't know what the hell is going on at that point, you know, at the end of the film there. Now that's why it cuts when it does.
And it also leaves it possibly, you could do a sequel to it like way in the future, or it works out. Just ending like that too, so he left it sort of open to either, you know, in case it was a big hit. And now I don't see this movie, like, I couldn't see it being a big hit, but I just don't see why. Maybe, you know, I mean, there was before this was Big Trouble in Little China, and before that was Starman. So maybe the expectations from the critics from John Carpenter were really high. They didn't want to see.
I mean, before Starman was the thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's. Between, you know, I mean, you're talking about three films that not only did good business, but generally were well-received. I mean, even The Thing, which is a pretty gruesome film for its time, you know, it was taken for what it was, which was a hard R horror film. But it did good business, and I remember getting, you know, got pretty good write-ups.
For the most part, it got denounced for the gore at first, but, you know, whatever.
That's what happens when you go head-to-head with E.T., though.
Yeah, right. But
we call,
you know,
that counter programming.
And when that movie hit HBO, oh my god, man, people went nuts. You know, that was what I didn't get to see that on in the theater. I got to see that on HBO, and like all my friends would come home and be like, you know, I didn't sleep last night. Wait till you see The Thing. It's insane. It's so scary. It was awesome.
Oh. But, we can edit this next line out, but when we talk about The Thing, I'll have to get some pictures. My brother is a figure modeler.
Yeah?
He loves doing stuff from The Thing, and he actually has the dog. He has a kit of the dog that he built. He's got a kit of, you know, when they test all the blood in the petri dishes. He's got that, and it looks like it's a fucking thing jumping out of this petri dish. It freaks me out every time. I'll have to get some pictures of that we'll share when we talk about The Thing.
I hope they don't remake that movie again.
Well, you know, at this point, they're remaking Suspiria. If you're remaking Suspiria,
what?
As far as I'm concerned, you can just throw all the rules out the window. Because if you're going to remake in less than a decade, remake Dawn of the Dead, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria, you know, just bend me over and call me Susan, because I've had enough.
Well, I'll say this, you know, Dawn of the Dead and... You know, Nightmare on Elm Street and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I can understand those being remade more than Suspiria.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is so stylish and so its own thing, you know, it's just why? Unless it was Dario Argento himself, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, the point of a remake is that you're cashing in on the notoriety of the name. You know, you remake Dawn of the Dead, or you remake Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or Nightmare on Elm Street, or Friday the 13th, or Halloween, or what have you, because those are names that everybody knows. There's a built-in brand there.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, the people who know Suspiria are not going to be
yeah, they're not
going to
be happy
this.
That you're remaking it.
Yeah.
this provides an interesting segue into another one of my notes. Talking about Dario Argento, one of the things that I like about all the various swarms of bugs in this film. We see the ants right at the very beginning, and then again on Marsh's, on the back of Marsh's television. And, of course, we got bugs and worms and all that creepy crawly stuff all throughout the film. You know, they serve a very minor purpose in the story. They're, you know, they talk about that he can control simple creatures and simple minds. They don't, you know, they don't serve a narrative function other than that. But those scenes reminded me, there's a scene in the film Deep Red by Dario Argento where there are two dogs fighting. Okay, and the one dog ends up grabbing the other dog by the neck and is shaking him around. It serves literally no purpose at all in the narrative. It's never touched on again. It doesn't affect the protagonist in any way. And Argento said that the only reason that he put that scene in the film was to not provide any relief at all. There's no moment where, and that's in Deep Red, where the audience gets relief. Okay? And so that's kind of how I look at all the swarms and stuff. It's like anything could be going on, and then randomly, here's a big pile of crawly, creepy bugs.
Yep.
Have fun with that.
Yep. Well, where the one woman was like, I'm so glad you're opening up the church again, Father, and like, and he looks into her cup, and it looks like a cup of like rotten meat or something, you know, some sort of doctored up grossness. And a lot of those scenes, there were a lot of things in that reminded me of Stephen King. Like maybe he'd been reading some he was definitely a Stephen King fan because he did Christine. And like the scene where, you know, I've got a message for you and you're not going to like it. That scene, and the way the guy's voice was gargling and gurgling, you know, I could see, while I was watching and hearing that scene, I could see like totally how Stephen King would write that scene out. You know, it seemed like something out of a Stephen King. But I loved how that guy's clothing just like slowly collapsed in on itself, sort of like 9/11, just collapsed in its own footprint, you know, of bugs. And
when I talk about a simple but effective special effect, you know, you don't get much more simple than a suit of clothes propped up, you know, that falls apart as a bug wrangler pumps roaches and beetles out of it.
Yeah,
I mean that is simple as all hell. If you had the bugs, you could shoot that for the price of a suit.
Yeah,
but you watch that and you're like, oh man, that is awesome.
Well, it's all timing. It's beautifully edited how the head fall, you know, the timing of the head falling off, and there's and as soon as the head falls off, there's just a great reaction shot of everybody who's been looking out the window at him, and that head, although that guy did have a great movie mullet, there was a lot of 80s. Everybody had their 80s hair. The 80s were when all the women dressed like they were in like Sunday school. You know, all the like attractive but not bombshell women, like in a Carpenter movie, if they're attractive and not a bombshell, they all had. It was just that way in the 80s, you know, the like sort of collared dresses and the prim librarian hairstyles and stuff like that. And it's weird because I watch it and I'm like, that was hot back in 1987. In 1987, I would have seen all those ladies and gone, okay, they're attractive, pretty ladies. And now they look like they should be teaching Sunday school.
You know, it all the slope just gets more and more slippery the farther you go.
and this, I know I brought this up in the thread before, but I'm going to bring it up again. Jameson, I don't know if that's a real Jameson Parker mustache or one that they applied to his face, but it's wrong. I'm thinking he grew it because it's like literally one of those ones where people are like, is that a caterpillar on your face? Like his hair didn't grow, like the hairs of it didn't grow evenly. It's just a monstrosity. And I'm thinking maybe he had to wear it because they didn't want him to look like his role in Simon and Simon. So they're like, you're going to have a mustache for this. But
maybe the mustache is a manifestation of the fact that evil is, you know, being sprung upon the world.
That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. It's a simple life form that's taken on its own, you know, and if it could stab somebody, it would. But really, it just spends the whole movie trying to move off his face.
I'll offer a counterpoint on that. Anything that beautiful.
Thank you. Anything well, we haven't heard from you in a while, so I need to...
Yeah,
I was going to say, anything that beautiful and majestic could not be the tool of Satan.
the majesty of Jameson Parker's facial hair.
It's beautiful.
There's... But, there's just some... I love the one scene where the guy stabs himself in the neck. That's creepy as hell.
Well, he's singing Amazing Grace at the time.
That
makes it weirder.
That whole scene is just that whole scene is just bananas, because it's like, first off, all throughout the film earlier, Carter is this, he's always like really overexcited.
Yeah.
Like when they're arguing outside, he's like yelling at the guy and everyone else is talking. And he's just overly excited, and then he gets the Satan juice and he just goes apeshit. You know, it's like this guy is gone. And then he's just laughing the whole time when he's possessed after he cuts his throat.
But he's doing that conflicted, serious, and like half of his, you know, and not like the right half and the left half, but even parts of his face are half like dead serious and hysterically, insanely laughing. And it's really creepy, coupled with copious amounts of sweat. It's very Star Trek, the original series, to me. I love that. And I love that he gets sort of like trapped in front of the mirror in that one scene. That was, I thought, really neat and creepy.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
There were just a lot of things that happened in this movie that weren't explained that I think Carpenter had an explanation for, but he was just like, I'll just, you know, there was something going on when he was looking in that mirror and just sort of like laughing and freaking out with Donald Pleasance. But you don't really find out why it is that that's going on, but I know there was a reason for it.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes how much of some of the things like the way that Carter is acting after he's possessed and all that, how much of that was written and how much of that was ad-lib. You know, because there's a lot of little things that happen in Prince of Darkness that you look at and you're like, that's got to be an ad-lib. Because but nobody would take the time to write that. And like when they first bring all the research students down into the catacombs and they're looking at the Satan in a can, and there's one guy who crosses himself. You know, well, no one else is. Well, I think it's Donald Pleasance is giving his little spiel, and everyone's just standing there. There's one guy off to the left of the panel who does the sign of the cross, and it's like that seems like something that would be an ad lib. You know, but it adds to it because there would be at least one person who was of enough faith in those catacombs that would do that.
Yeah, and it would also, I mean, they make it very clear that all around that thing is a really bad vibe. Everybody who goes in there, you can see them sort of like, you know, get serious when they walk in there and they're just like, whoa, something's going on in here. You know, whether it's a physical sensation or whatever it is, but you get the feeling that the hackles are raising up on the back of their neck. And that's about the most complicated effect in there, is Satan in a can.
Yeah.
I never pictured it to look that way, but hey, you know, subatomic particles. What do you got?
No, I always pictured like a can of like that deviled ham with the little devil on it. That's more like Satan in a can. It is
that would
to my
be delicious.
Digestive tract. It is delicious.
That would be a Satan I could get behind.
Well, you know, I mean, Satan always tastes good going down, but once he gets in your digestive tract, that's another
thing. You know what they say, you know, what you do today will burn your ass tomorrow. So.
I wonder if they even make that Red Devil stuff. But I guess this movie was supposed to be the middle movie in his Apocalypse trilogy, which was going to be, I guess it was. I guess he considered The Thing, this movie, and Mouth of Madness, another underrated movie that didn't get really trashed as much as this, as much as it just got completely ignored. And, you know, just sort of jumped in and out of theaters for 10 minutes.
Well, Village of the Damned came out the same year, didn't it?
That's right.
So he's competing against himself.
Yeah, competing against himself with a big budget studio film versus a smaller, you know, a smaller kind of a what we used to call a B picture, you know. But I'll tell you, he'll win that battle every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and Superman and Luke Skywalker.
I was lucky enough. I got to see that movie in Ithaca, New York, in the State Theater, which is a classic old Bijou theater with the balconies and everything. It was really, my friend Jack and I were like, "Hey, it's a John Carpenter movie," you know. So we went to see it. I hadn't even heard of it, you know, just a John Carpenter's Mouth of Madness. All right, we'll go to this. And it was one of those things where we were the only two people in this huge old Bijou theater. It's a place where usually bands like Fish or something will play there, you know. And it was very strange, but it was appropriately spooky for that movie. And I was just like, oh, wow, this is like a Lovecraft movie. And there's some Lovecraftian angles with Prince of Darkness, although it sort of takes that. I remember a lot of the critics didn't like the whole Jesus was an alien sent to protect us aspect of the story. They sort of threw that out, that the devil was an antimatter being and Jesus was an alien protector.
Mm. Well, the odd thing about that, you know, is that, you know, they make a point about saying that all of the writing in the book, a lot of it has been changed and written over and tried to be destroyed over the years, and that this is it's a theology student, Lisa, who is translating it, mm-hmm. but she's interpreting it while she's translating it, you know? So, you know, she's not a philosopher or a theoretical physics major or anything like that, so we're getting her spin on it, too, you know, from what there exists of it. Could it have been something different at one point? You know, we're not sure because our source is not something that we can inherently trust because they made a point of showing us that our source is not constant.
Right, and I love, just another aside, is I love the old shots in those days of people working on computers. You know, she's translating it and she's just typing it word for, you know, what she's saying verbally, she's typing it into the computer, and I'm thinking, why would you be doing that? You know, she's just sort of typing it onto the screen. I'd be writing it down, would be probably faster or whatever, you know, or just reading it out loud and have someone tape record it or something. But it's just funny. I love, you know, it was like watching War Games and stuff like that when in those days people could, the interpretation of someone using a computer could be completely different. They could just sort of do anything they wanted on it. Whereas nowadays everybody's computer savvy enough that you can't get away with that sort of stuff. Although I was wondered about her lines where she's like, yeah, it would be easy to translate. It should be easy enough to translate, except for the numbers. And I'm like, I wonder why would numbers be any less easy to translate than words, you know?
You know, she's a theology student. They don't take math.
Yeah, we don't. No. I'm not. Yeah, I have trouble distinguishing the numbers. I don't have to deal with those too much.
Oh, the line I love in this film. This was one of the films that when I was in college we used to have. Near to Clemson University, where I went to school, they had what used to be a movies, and it had a cow theme. And it had, you know, and they had, and then it eventually became a video update, and then eventually it closed, and I bought a bunch of old horror rack hangers-on from them. But anyway, back when they were movies, I used to, you know, subject all of my friends, who, none of whom were horror fans, to, you know, whatever I wanted to rent, because I was trying to educate them in the field of horror, and Prince of Darkness was one of the films we watched. And, you know, the line that is repeated three times in this film is, when they're looking for Susan, I think her name is, and somebody goes, "Who? Radiologist? Glasses?"
That's right.
So
that's right.
That became any time that between when I was in school with any of my friends, if somebody we asked a question and somebody said, "What?" You say, "Radiologist? Glasses?" And then you realize why they can't find her, because once she's possessed, she doesn't have her glasses anymore.
Oh.
So it's like, oh, well, that can't be Susan. She's not wearing glasses.
She's a radiologist, but no glasses.
So every now and again, I'll break that out, and my wife will just look at me like I have three heads, and I'll say, oh, right, you've never seen Prince of Darkness. So.
You and 99.999% of the rest of the world.
Actually, it was funny. She came in, she and my son came back from the store right at the end when she's reaching through the mirror, and you could see her watch. And she goes, oh, good. All the undead need to know what time it is. And I said, she's not the undead. She's possessed by the son of Satan. She goes, oh, that's much better. I'm like, just leave me alone, please. Let me watch my movie in peace.
I thought the scene when she got sucked into, when she got thrown into the mirror, and the just the one quick shot afterwards of her reaching towards the, you know, where the mirror had broken, was, that was probably the creepiest shot in the whole movie.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That was awesome. It was claustrophobic and just, like, sort of pounded the fact home that her fate was not good.
Yeah.
And was probably going to be protracted also.
And you're right, it's quick. They don't beat you over the head with it. There's one of the Nightmare sequels. I think I want to say it's 5 or 4, where the kid gets trapped in his own waterbed and drowns.
That was four.
Yeah, four and five. I love those the later movies in that series, so they all get kind of blurred together. But you know, in that one, they kind of beat you over the head with it, you know, of him drowning. Whereas in this, you're just like, oh, yeah, she's screwed. You know, you just see that one shot and that's it. And speaking of the mirror, it's kind of goofy now, but I really still dig when she's pulling out, you know, Anti-God's hand, and it's the big claw,
yeah,
big demonic claw. It's so old school, but it's like, of course that's what it looks like. You know, if it looked like something else, you'd be like, well, you know, okay, but of course it's a big red hand with black claws on it.
Well, the, you know, the image of Satan had to come from somewhere.
Yeah. I also like the use of the Tom and Jerry cartoon, where, you know, Tom falls into hell and Spike is the devil and he's putting him in the big pot.
And what about, remember there was a scene earlier where the TV's going and it's like, you know, a new, there was a supernova, was it a supernova that was discovered? And they're like, you know, and the lights, and I was wondering... I wonder if they're setting it up that, you know, maybe has something, one of the things that's going on is the light from this supernova had to hit Earth, you know, maybe that's one of the things that are somehow affecting, you know, the activity of Satan in a can.
Yeah. I'd be willing to buy that, because one thing I've come to... come to realize is that John Carpenter doesn't put anything into his films by accident. Even the most trivial thing has some meaning. You know, it may not be completely obvious, but it has the purpose for being there. You know, and if it was just supposed to be background noise, they could have put another Tom and Jerry cartoon on the TV, you know?
Yeah, yeah. This is a perfect opportunity. I watched another movie last night. It's called, it just came out this year, and it's called Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue, and it's a documentary, you know, on horror films, American horror films, you know, from Edison's Frankenstein up, and basically, you know, applying, doing the general, you know, okay, the Cold War, you know, paranoia and Vietnam era style horror, and you know, up till today with torture porn and stuff. But a lot of the movie is a long interview with John Carpenter. So there's a lot of John Carpenter movies, and there's even a clip from Prince of Darkness in it. And there's a lot of, especially towards the end, Carpenter gets to talk a lot, and he's very, very intelligent and very well spoken. It was a great interview that they have with him. There's also an interview with Wes Craven in there that's pretty good, and George Romero, of course. But Yeah, that would be a good that would be a good movie to sort of go along with this movie or any other John Carpenter movie that we're going to be talking about. Speaking of which, what movie do you think we should do next?
Ooh, tough call.
There's so many.
Well, do we want to, I guess, stick to just the horror films for the format?
Well, no, I wouldn't mind eventually doing every John Carpenter movie. Well, I don't know. I could skip, like, Memoirs of an Invisible Man doesn't really have elements of horror in it. Like, Starman is pushing it, but you could argue, you know, we could get away with it. We can do whatever we want, you know. Nobody's going to, like, fire us or anything.
You know, I mean, you don't have to ask me twice to watch Escape from New York or Assault on Precinct 13, but those fill other generic roles, you know, outside of a horror, you know. Whereas, you know, we stick to stuff like, you know, The Thing or Halloween. You know, we're going to be right in the wheelhouse. So,
yeah. Well, I'm thinking if we do The Thing next, and. Let's do The Thing next, and then Mouth of Madness after that, and we'll have covered his Apocalypse trilogy.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure it out from there, because, you know, I know it's not horror. I would love to do Big Trouble in Little China. I love that movie, and I have like a great story going along with how I got to see that movie the first time. And, you know, I wouldn't mind doing, you know, his, was it the Masters of Horror episodes?
Yeah, he had a couple of those.
I've only seen the first one of those.
I've only seen the first one, too.
The only Masters of Horror ones I've watched are Argento's, so.
I haven't watched totally those, but I heard they were really good.
Yeah, Jennifer is one of them, which is excellent, and Peltz is the other one of Argento's.
Now, Oh, go ahead.
Was Jennifer the one with the chick that gets found in the woods?
Yes.
Oh my God, that was creepy.
Wasn't Peltz like? Didn't they have to cut it, or was there some sort of controversy?
That was Imprint.
It was Imprint. It was Mikkei's one, which was they wouldn't air it in its original. They had to cut it, and then they released the uncut DVD and all that.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's it. What did you say in the when you're media masochist about the Serbian film? If it's Japanese people, it must be fucked up.
Well, yes. There's another movie out called Red, White, and Blue, and it's a horror movie. It's a slasher movie. I was just reading the review of it in Film Threat, and the guy was like, you know, I the movie shocked him 2 weeks after he saw a Serbian film.
Well, that can't be good.
And he said it's basically a slasher film, but it spends the first 50 minutes of the movie really building up the characters extremely well. And so then when it turns into a slasher movie, it's pretty insane. So I don't know. I've been looking around to see if I can find. I haven't been able to even find a trailer for it or anything yet, but I'm keeping my eyes peeled.
Yeah, I just IMDb'd it. Now I'm intrigued.
Keeping my eyes peeled and salted for it. If there's any other listeners out there who are also interested in hopping in on in the horror club, you know, if you have some favorite horror movies, or especially John Carpenter movies, and the, you know, right.
That'd be a good, like you said, that's a good foundation. We start with just doing Carpenter for a while, and then we can branch off to other directors, other series. Mm-hmm. You know, we can start moving in that, you know, in other directions.
Well, I'd like to use this as a way to, like, instead as. You know, I like being like, this is a good horror movie. Yes, we all like it. You should see it. But, you know, I would... That works more like with something like Prince of Darkness, which a lot of people may not have seen. But maybe with something, you know, with stuff like The Thing, or if we, you know, or end up doing something like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that, I'd like to use it as more of a means of going a little more in depth than just like, hey, that was really good, you know, this was a really good scene, and that, and put it in more of a historical context and have a little more fun with it that way.
Yeah, so much of horror is prevalent upon the time that it's made in. I mean,
yeah, you
almost have to give the historical background. I was gonna say, especially with Carpenter, who's such a political firebrand in his own right.
Yeah, one of his quotes in the Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue was, he was talking about, he's just like, you know, all these directors who are do the most bloody, gory, horrifyingly evil movies, he's like, are all anti-war, you know, you know, super peaceful, mellow people that, like, he's like, that have, you know, are, you know, they have a garden at their house and they're just, you know, generally gentle. And he's like, it's the people that are trying to prevent them from making those movies that are the scary ones. And
you know what they say, that's why all the best horror movies come out when there's a Republican in office.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Say what you will about the country, but when George W. Bush was in the office, we got a lot of good horror movies.
You know what, though? With George W. Bush, that didn't happen that usually happens. Like, with Reagan, we got awesome punk rock music. With Bush, there wasn't that musical. I guess maybe on the rap side there was a little bit of you know, social commentary, or, you know, there was social commentary music, but, you know, not that divine inspiration of having that enemy to drive you, you know, that seemed to drive punk rock in the during the, you know, late 70s and Reagan era. And I miss that. But we did get horror movies galore, and some really good and crazy ones. There's been just a wild run of the French were putting out a whole bunch of, you know, nasty stuff for a while, and then Let the Right One In came out, and
well, you know, the general tropes of horror, as far as from a production standpoint, never change. Okay, a horror film, for one thing, doesn't have to be expensive, it doesn't have to be complicated, and it doesn't have to have any, you know, anything in it other than something to scare, frighten, or unnerve the audience. So horror has always been made cheaply, and horror has always been very cost-effective because of that, because horror will always turn a tidy little profit because it's made cheaply.
And it's timely, too, because it's made quickly, so it's like right up to the minute with playing on people's fears and...
Yeah, I mean, we talked earlier about Roger Corman. Was there anybody better at making something in such a way to make it turn a profit? Didn't matter if it was the junkiest film you've ever seen. It could be Creature from the Haunted Sea with the Cookie Monster attacking people. But, you know, if you got a good poster and you got people that want to go out on Friday night to a double feature, they're sure as hell going to go see your movie.
Yeah, and if it was just so utterly terrible, he would package it with something else. And send it. Yeah, he was a genius in that. One of, as a film student, it's funny. Like, I've got all my texts from film school, and I remember researching what I would be reading in film school in high school, and getting the texts and reading them. And by the time I was in college and had read a lot of film books, you know, one of the most useful, like, if I was to tell somebody they were going to go study to be a filmmaker or something, one of the first books I'd tell them to read was the Roger Corman, you know, I can't remember what the number is. It's like, wait, I got it right in front of me here. It was something, oh, How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. And he does. He basically, it's literally, he goes through each movie and tells you what the production was like, what he wanted to do with it, how terrible it was, how good it was, you know, some of them were labors of love. Other ones were just like, I bought this movie from a Czechoslovakian film company and we took all the sound off it and then edited these scenes in from this other movie that we never finished. And it's insane. It's incredible, but it's a great insight into the artistic. There's also one that, now I can't remember his name off the top of my head. The head of Troma, Lloyd Kaufman.
And
it was like something like, all I ever needed to learn about filmmaking, I learned from the Toxic Avenger. and that's inspirational. You know, you read it and here's somebody who, you know, was making movies out of nothing, you know, out of being able to talk dentists into investing into the, into, you know, some horribly crappy movie that, that was going to get people to rent it on video.
Yeah.
Because of its title.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of my favorite filmmakers for crap cinema is Charles Band, who ran Full Moon Entertainment for a long, long time. And Full Moon Entertainment, Charles Band, they created the method of the pre-sell to make your money at the video store.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why there's so many sequels to Puppet Master and Subspecies, and it ain't because people were clamoring for more Puppet Master and Subspecies movies. Now, keep in mind, this is someone who owns both the Puppet Master and Subspecies box sets.
Well, people, you know, people bemoan the death of the drive-in by video, by VHS, but VHS, the video store, spawned its own low-budget underground horror movie market, and, you know... And there was lots of horrible shit, but that's how I did. I mean, I remember watching like a lot of those movies, and I would get suckered into them by a really nice poster, or you know, the promise of boobs and such. And you know, and 90% of the time, it would end up being just like horribly disappointing. But then you would get a Toxic Avenger where you're like, oh my God, there's some actual wit in this movie. And, you know, and I'm laughing my ass off through this whole thing, you know. And
with the technology that's there today, there's, if you want to make a film, you can do it.
Yep. There's no excuse. Yeah, if you want it, you can do it all with consumer-level equipment. And, that would look better than a lot of those straight-to-video 80s movies. Whoa, man. We had some great, horrible video stores, too, when I grew up. We had one that we had to actually drive, like, 3 miles out into the woods because that was a place we could rent pornos at.
That's important.
And it's funny because, like, the family that owned it, their daughter was, I think she was a couple years younger than us, you know, but we knew the daughter there. And so we would come in and we'd say hi to the daughter and her little brother. And then the mom would come out and my friend Todd would be like, can we see the big boy's book? And she'd be like, why, sure, boys. And pop it out. And you always have that one friend who's just very casual about porn, you know. He's just like, let's see. Ooh, hey. Hey, guys, what about this? This looks great. and she's like, going, oh, don't bother with that one. Don't bother with that one. Trust me.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was bizarre. But anyway, next time it will be The Thing. Oh, awesomeness, awesomeness.
And, yes, it is.
Shit, if we want to get really technical with it, we could watch both things.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could watch The Thing and The Thing from Another World.
I will add that to my Netflix queue.
Yes, I'll have to dig that one up too. But I haven't seen The Thing from Another World like all the way through since I was a little kid. And that scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's one of those ones that, you know, some of the earliest horror films I remember watching were all the Universal horrors, you know, because my dad's a big fan, but one of the other early ones is The Thing from Another World. I've got the VHS tape right here. That's how I roll.
Yeah.
In six-hour mode VHS, the tape probably cost $5. is this a colorized one? No, this is a black and white one. All right.
Did that one go public domain? at some point?
It may have gone public domain at some point. I don't think it is anymore. I think Turner has established rights over it.
Yeah,
I will look that up.
I just remember I always thought it would be stupid because when I was a kid I heard that James Arness played the monster and I was like, that's Matt Dillon from Gunsmoke. I can't see him as a monster. And then proceeding to, like, I was watching it on like a Sunday afternoon and almost on one of those like New York City cable, you know, WPIX monster movie broadcasts, and just like shitting my pants. So excellent. We'll do a little compare and contrast. And
yeah, I'm actually looking forward to seeing the original. I've never seen it.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a reason why The Thing from Another World got remade by John Carpenter.
Nice.
Yes, it's definitely right up his alley, and it's really we'll get into it when we do it, but not that far off from as people like to portray it as. But
yeah.
All right, so we'll see. We'll be back with the same crew. Join us next time, whenever it is. It's going to be an undetermined time where we will be talking about The Thing from the Other World, The Thing from Another World, and The Thing.
Awesome.
Hey, Toasty.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy. And there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Twotruefreaks.libsyn.com is spelled twotruefreaks.libsyn, which is libsyn.com.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
You can find me, Scott Gardner, both on Twitter and Facebook. My name is spelled ScottGardner. Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
We are also members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check it out at www.comicspodcasts.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up. Thanks for listening.
Join us every Monday for new episodes of Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.